Greetings and welcome. I'm Mark Pitstick, your host on Ask the Soul Doctors with HealthyLife.net Radio. After working with many thousands of people over the last 40 years, I've assembled sensible, evidence-based answers to the most commonly asked questions about life, death, and afterlife. And each month on this show, I interview experts on consciousness research who share their answers. We don't claim to have all the answers or the only answers, but we do have some very good answers that have helped many people make more sense of their Earth experience. And with us today to help answer those questions is Marilyn Schlitz, Ph.D. Dr. Schlitz is a social anthropologist, researcher, author, and lecturer. Most impressive to me, she is President Emeritus and a Senior Fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more than three decades, Marilyn has been a leader in the field of consciousness studies. She was the writer and executive producer, along with Dr. Deepak Chopra, of the movie Death Makes Life Possible. I was fortunate enough to be in Sedona last May for the world premiere of this documentary and thoroughly enjoyed it. And while watching it, I realized that Marilyn and I share very similar life work emphases, and I wanted to have her on the show. So, Marilyn, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, our listeners and I are looking forward to hearing your answers. You have a long and great history of dealing with consciousness topics, so let's get started. The first question, of course, people ask is, who am I? What are your understandings about that, please?
Well, I think that we are always answering that question in different ways, depending on our life circumstances, the stage in our own personal growth and development. There's obviously the me or the I that operates in life and has relationships, goes to a job, you know, gets educated, does the things that we do. And then there is this opportunity that people describe of a larger I, a we that is transcendent of just the physicality of our being, and so connecting to that through spiritual practice, through, you know, quantum physics even now is shedding light for us on what it means to be interconnected and the nature of our entanglements. So it's a complex question, I think, depending on our point of view and our place in life.
Sure. What else would you like to say about that one?
Well, I know for myself that, you know, we can think about how people make changes in their lives and how do we transform, how do we grow. And as we have over our years of research looking at transformations in consciousness and transformations in worldview, seeing that at the core of people's transformational experience can be what we called a noetic impulse. And that is some kind of direct personal experience in which people use the first-person pronoun, I. I had an experience of fill in the blank. Maybe it's a near death, out of body, some kind of mystical experience. It can also be something that is catalyzed in very simple ways. You know, somebody washing dishes and looking out the window and shifting their perspective and their understanding of who the I is. It can be more difficult for people. They can resist whatever these new impulses are, and we know that our brains are very capable of, you know, not learning new things. And so, you know, there is this way in which the first-person direct experience of I becomes fundamental in the growth that I'm going to make toward a larger sense of we.
Okay, great. So, as you well know, after people get a sense of who they are, then the next question, of course, you know, why am I here? Why would I be on a place like Earth?
Well, you know, we're meaning-making creatures, that's for sure, and we are hardwired to story our lives and give meaning and purpose to it, and ultimately we know that having meaning, having a sense of a why are we here, is really important for everything, for our happiness, for our physical health and well-being, for our relationships and our communities and our, you know, bigger sense of spirituality or religion, whatever it is. Am I here for a purpose, and what is that purpose? And, you know, people spend a lot of time in some some cases trying to answer that. In some cases, they answer it differently at different points in their life. And I think that, you know, spiritual practice or transformational practices, you know, provide methods for helping us to get a better answer to that, depending on what's going on in this moment. And, you know, oftentimes people are catalyzed to ask these questions when it comes out of some kind of painful experience, some disruption in our steady state. Otherwise, you know, everything's going along. I don't have to worry too much about who I am and why I'm here. I'm just doing it. And then something can happen. It may be, you know, the death of a loved one, the loss of a job, a divorce, you know, something that destabilizes us from our steady state. And that can cause us to refocus and redefine what is our purpose. And, you know, in that process, I think we have some opportunities to engage in things that are of quality and of authenticity, that allow us to really think about how do we want to be in relationship with ourselves. Are we exercising? Are we eating well? Are we practicing some kind of stress reduction tools? And then there's also the idea that we can begin to really want to redefine our relationship to the broader meaning system of the universe. And so is that spiritual? Is that religious? These systems provide us with a great deal of meaning, and so that's, I think, an important pathway into why am I here. Each of us has to answer that question for ourselves.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And so a third question that people typically ask then is, so what happens after I die, or what are the range of possibilities for that?
I've been really interested, as you mentioned, in consciousness studies and have looked at consciousness through a variety of different methods. I started as an experimental parapsychologist and looking at the idea that our consciousness may have these capacities to reach out and extend beyond our physical being, and that we were able to design experimental protocols in a laboratory under, you know, randomized double-blind conditions that allowed us to document the possibility that one person's intention can reach out and cause physiological changes in another person. So this suggests that there's something about our consciousness that is beyond the body. I then started doing research. For about 20 years, I've been looking at the nature of worldview transformation. And, you know, we collected stories from people about their own transformative process, you know, what catalyzed it, what sustained it, what did it lead to in their experience. We interviewed masters from 60 different world traditions. We did a survey of about 2,000 average householders so that we could compare what happens with the adepts who really do drop out and live in a cave compared to the everyday person. And from all of that, we created a change model. And one of the big factors in transformation, obviously, is, you know, our relationship to death and what happens after, and what is the meaning system that we place on that. What we found is that there's a huge denial around death, and that fear, terror, actually, around our own mortality leads to a lot of aberrant behaviors, creates a lot of intolerance toward other people, aggression, you know, stress and distress around ourselves and other people. And so I think, you know, part of the answer to the question is, what does it mean to live? And how do we fully engage our embodiment and the fact that this is a huge gift that we've been given, and how to bring meaning and purpose into every moment of that process? And at the same time, you know, people ask the question, what happens after? And again, people answer it very differently. I've been, for the last 3 years, making this film that you mentioned, Death Makes Life Possible, and in that process, interviewing people who represent different worldviews, different ontologies, you know, different models about the afterlife, and have found a wide, wide variety of answers to that question. There does seem to be, you know, everything from the atheist, who Michael Shermer I interviewed, who, you know, believes there's nothing after, to the people who, you know, have very sophisticated cosmologies, like in the Buddhist tradition, of different you know, spheres that we move through as we reach our next stage of embodiment, reincarnation. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways, different cultures that answer the question from their own meaning system and truth system. There's also the way in which science is, you know, attempting to answer that question, what happens after. So, you know, in the film we talk about the study of mediumship, for example, people who believe they can channel the discarnate entity, the, you know, the personality of the deceased person. And so we've been looking at what happens in their brains, and does something happen in their brains that's different when they believe they're in contact with the spirit as compared to when they don't. And it does appear that in the sort of memory center of the brain, during these periods where the mediums seem to be in contact, it opens up and there's like sort of less memory, as though the brain is creating a space for a different memory system to come in. So that's all very preliminary, but interesting. There's the fascinating work that's being done at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville on reincarnation and documenting thousands of cases of people who, you know, have evidence that supports their belief that they were somebody in a past life and, you know, really trying to systematically explore these things. So there's different ways. There's the, you know, basic science work that I started with, which suggests that consciousness is more than just our physical being, which then supports the idea that it may have some place it goes after, to all the cultural perspectives that, you know, support the idea that there's something more to us than our physicality, to then what science is beginning to tell us about the nature of our transcendent capacities. So it's an exciting time where these different truth systems are coming together. And for me personally, there's no one right answer. Again, I'm going to say, as an anthropologist, I really think that we each have to come up with an understanding of who we are, what our purpose is, and what's going to happen after. And I think as we engage those questions, you know, life fills in and it gives us different sets of possibilities.
Well, you're right. This is an exciting time to be alive and look at the question, because we have the benefit of timely wisdom traditions as well as contemporary evidence so put together. And then also we want to leave room for the mystery, you know, the X factor. That's part of the excitement. Well, you've alluded to this a bit, but in your research, and of course this, all of these questions are asking about your professional as well as your personal opinions, but what is your opinion about a higher power, a source energy, a God, and if so, what is this phenomena like?
Again, you know, I can only answer for myself, and I guess maybe I live in a kind of complicated worldview, but it holds that there are a multiplicity of perspectives that can exist simultaneously. So, you know, I don't have like a kind of final trump card that I think is the answer, and I'm really much more interested in what are the questions that we can ask that are revealed through these, you know, mystical experiences that people report. You know, one of the people I interviewed, his name is Yasir Chadli, and he's an imam from the Sufi tradition, and he had been on the swim team as a teenager growing up in Morocco. And he describes this experience one day. It was not, there weren't enough waves, and so they just went out, and he was kind of body surfing, and he was floating on the waves, and suddenly he had this experience that his body grew bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally it was one. And he had that kind of unitive, mystical, Sumadhi-type experience that people describe, and it really informed the rest of his life. So there was a sense of his own connection to Allah, or the One, in his tradition. You know, I had the whole transformation research project began one day when a very successful businessman, Jewish by upbringing but pretty secular, had one of these opening experiences that, you know, gave him insight into the divine. And he wanted to understand it. And he came to my office and said, you know, tell me what the research says. Do other people have these experiences? And if they do, you know, what can we learn? And if they don't, how can we help them to have them? Because they really are great. And And so we started doing research, and the literature basically said, you know, people who have these mystical opening experiences are either delusional or psychotic. And that was not what we were hearing from people, you know. And so the scientific and psychological literatures have, you know, some questions around these kinds of experiences, these mystical, you know, spiritual, religious experiences. And at the same time, I would say in that 20 years that we were working on that project, you know, it has changed so much. And in fact, I just saw an article today, a new study that's being done looking at the differences between religion and spirituality in terms of how people define their lives and how they answer the questions that you're answering. And I just skimmed it, but it looks to me like they're saying basically religion provides a set of rules and boundaries, and spirituality provides this opening to ask questions and experience our sense of oneness with whatever, you know, we put a name on. So I think there's just lots of answers to that question about, you know, what is the divine? Is there a God? Is it one God? Is it, you know, is it a person personified in some form? Or is it really something that we have no language to articulate and yet get glimpses into when we have these kind of opening experiences? You know, people do things like a walk in nature. And, you know, if it's done with a kind of intention and attention, it can be revelatory, and people can really feel grace. And the same in a meditation state. If people sit down and can get themselves into, you know, a deep mindfulness state or a contemplative prayer type state, you know, there are glimpses and openings for people to whatever the answer is for them about this question. And it's a beautiful inquiry.
Well put. Well, listeners, you can see why I wanted to have her on, and the breadth of her research, and also kind of like a politician, a little hard to pin you down, but that's part of being a scientific researcher, so good for you. Well, with this background, Marilyn, of course, a question that arises in most people's lives is why is there suffering, and especially it's difficult to understand when there are little children involved. What can you share with us about that?
Yeah, well, I can say for sure it's real, and that, you know, people suffer. And I know working at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, you know, Edgar Mitchell, who was the founder, was one of the Apollo 14 astronauts, and he had the opportunity to go to the moon, walk on the moon, and then because his part of the mission was complete, he had the window seat on the way home. And so he had the privilege of looking out that little portal as they were blasting through space, and to watch the sun, the moon, and the earth rising and setting as the space capsule did what they called the barbecue rotation. And so he was able to see what, you know, now is kind of a common image, but of, you know, planet Earth, this beautiful, pristine whole suspended in the vastness of space, and to see it in all its perfection. And he had kind of two responses or two experiences, and one was deep suffering. And he really felt the pain of our planet. And as he looked at planet Earth in all its wholeness, he didn't see national boundaries, state boundaries, race boundaries, ethnic boundaries, gender boundaries, you know, age boundaries. He didn't see any of that. He just saw that it was something whole and beautiful. So this idea of suffering isn't something inherent in the planet, but really inherent in the inhabitants of planet Earth. And so we are these meaning-making creatures who define things with certain values and judgments, and suffering is one of those. And in part, suffering comes from a natural developmental response to things that happen in our lives. It also comes from our worldview and where we place our attention. And there are tools that can help people to overcome grief, to live through the grief, but to get back to life. And again, going to the science, we see that, you know, it had been thought that people can be incapacitated by these, you know, profound experiences of suffering, the loss of a child, the, you know, the death of a loved one. These things are big in our lives. Big, big, big. But what we're discovering is that people, by and large, are more resilient than, you know, we give ourselves credit for. And so to be aware of our resilience, to be aware of the gift of life, to understand that grief is a process, and it comes, and then we move through it, not ever forgetting, but redefining. And if we go back to the question about what does it mean, you know, what happens after death, that becomes an important question for understanding this issue of suffering, and particularly the loss of loved ones.
Dr. Schlitz, you had mentioned some tools for handling suffering when that comes up in life. Could you share some of those, please?
Great. Well, I think that we have been looking at what are the different ways in which people can experience grief, can experience suffering. And in my book that will be coming out in May with the same title, Death Makes Life Possible, you know, I go into some depth around issues of transformation and how our relationship to death is part of the transformational process. Part of that process is grief and dealing with suffering, dealing with loss. And, you know, the first thing is really acknowledging it, that it's real and that people experience pain. But, you know, going back to the story of Edgar Mitchell and his feeling about, you know, planet Earth, it is a lot about our own worldview and how we hold what gives us meaning and purpose in life. And so how we relate to and understand grief is also seen through this lens of our worldviews and our culture and our religious and social upbringing. So it becomes something that we define each of us in our own way. Some of the tools that we have found can be both individual. It's, you know, for me really working at my own grief, as well as then collective practices that involve shared grief experiences. You know, I practice gratefulness meditation, and I was with a best friend who was dying of a brain tumor, and I was driving back and forth between her house and mine, and the Golden Gate Bridge lies in between, and I love the Golden Gate Bridge. It's such a great place to really remember gratefulness, and it's an easy place to feel grateful, and yet I was really suffering. I was feeling the loss and the pain and just the trauma of the whole experience of her passing. And so how does one find gratitude in these moments of hardship? And that is a spiritual practice, and it becomes an opportunity to look at what are the qualities that we're experiencing. In my case, the fact that I had a relationship with somebody that I cared that much about, that I could feel that much loss, was really something to honor and to be grateful for. And the gift that the person who's dying can give us, the living, even when it doesn't feel that way, of being part of this mysterious process of transformation and, you know, being with somebody and being able to offer them something, you know, a little squeeze of the hand or, you know, a cool washcloth on the forehead. Those are things that we can do to help ease the suffering of another. But we also recognize that when a person is passing in our presence, and hospice people will say this for sure, that it's a gift to the person who stays behind because we have been honored. We've been honored in that moment. And so those are ways, I think, that we can begin to redefine grief, and for myself, a practice being gratefulness meditation. But there are many practices that people can use. In the film Death Makes Life Possible, we interview Lauren Artress, who's a canon at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and she is well known for her work with the labyrinth. And the labyrinth is basically a meditative pathway. It came out of Chartres Cathedral during the time of the Inquisition and the Crusades, and people were wanting to make their pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and because it was dangerous and because it was expensive, they created these surrogate sites, in a certain sense, where they were destination points for people who wanted to experience the pilgrimage and that connection. And so going into the beautiful contemplative maze that, it's not exactly a maze, but it's a big pattern that is on the floor and you walk it. So these labyrinths are now all over the world. They're in churches and schools and public parks. And, you know, they're a place where people have an opportunity to go and have a walk through a pattern of contemplation that allows them to process their grief. So it becomes a tool for understanding and reflecting and connecting to the person who has departed. We also know that, you know, people practice sitting meditations. And using meditation as a way to become mindful of what's happening in our bodies and our minds as a result of our loss and our experience of connection. And it's both. It's both loss and connection, because I think that, you know, personally, there's every reason to believe that we stay connected. It's just defining that connection in a different form. So there are these personal practices. You know, contemplative prayer becomes a really important tool for people. Journaling, writing, doing creative expression, arts, dreaming. People report very therapeutic experiences in the context of these embodiment dreams where they sense their loved one there with them in some way. Those can be very exhilarating for people, and, you know, gives them a real, you know, tangible feeling of connection to their departed. And then there are the collective practices that we can do where it involves things like, you know, the Day of the Dead ceremony, which is held, it's about a month-long practice in the fall of every year, and it comes out of the Mexican tradition. The belief is that the veil between the living and the dead becomes thin at that time of year, and so there's more access to communication with the departed. And so people make little altars, and they offer food and drink and put up a picture so that they can remember the person, and they talk to them. There's no sense that that person someplace else. They have a sense that there is a direct communication. And not only is that a personal process, but then they have, you know, big parties and celebrations. Like the Irish have the wake. You know, different traditions, the Celts had the same philosophy, you know, where there is this idea that honoring the dead, because the dead are here, they're with us and in us, and it isn't all so sad. It's also a time to celebrate their lives and our lives and, you know, what it means to be alive, because that's ultimately the gift and the opportunity in this process of, you know, contemplating mortality.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you for those tools. Now, the next question people often ask is if they'll see their departed loved ones, and we know that's the case from near-death experiences, for example, after-death contacts. But you mentioned with the Mexican culture, actually a more auspicious time to communicate. But what can you share with others how they perhaps can continue that different relationship with loved ones who have passed on?
Yeah, I think, again, it's how we hold it, and it can take different forms, and there's different levels of, you know, comfort for people. As I said, the dreaming state, and, you know, people can begin to cultivate dream recall, for example. You know, some people say, I never dream, but we know that we dream, it's just we're not remembering it. And so, you know, learning to recall our dreams, setting an intention before we go to sleep at night. And then keeping a notepad near a bed and seeing if images come up. Peter Fenwick is one of the people that I've worked with and interviewed for the film, and he describes these death experiences. He's collected thousands of cases of people who, as they're dying, report being visited by their loved ones. And so it's as though these spirits are hanging around and, you know, available to help make that transition a smooth one. That's a comforting thought. And as people, you know, can begin to become, you know, familiar with that, as they invite in those guardians who can help us, that becomes a means of connection. People describe going to mediums and, you know, having some kind of communion with That works for some people, not for others. And, you know, for myself, I think you can go and sit in nature and be quiet. And spirit speaks through the trees and the birds and the animals. And, you know, that can become a way of feeling connected to life and to the departed and, the sort of seamlessness of what is on this side and what, you know, potentially exists on the other.
Good. So I think one reason why some people might be hesitant to try to contact their loved ones is they're afraid of maybe opening a door to what they might call the dark side, ghosts, evil or malevolent, capricious spirits. What has been your research and experience about that?
Well, for sure, there are people who have fears around it, and a lot of the traditions have cultivated that fear. You know, several people I've interviewed were, you know, brought up in very fundamentalist upbringing where there was a lot of talk about hell and damnation. And that is scary to think that that's what you're heading into and that there's this incredible judgment. You know, that's only held by a certain group and in a certain way. So if people can liberate themselves from, you know, these kind of inhibiting worldviews and begin to see possibility. It's also the case that in the Day of the Dead practices, it is to appease the spirits. It's the idea that sometimes these spirits can be mischievous and can create harm for us. And so it's also intended to keep them happy, to let them know they're respected and still, you know, part of the family. And that's something that becomes, you know, again, a tool for us to sit with, to engage with, and to reflect on our own worldview, because I think ultimately it's inviting each of us to consider what is true for us and what gives us meaning and where do we find comfort in the extended range of human possibility.
So, Marilyn, with your research and experience, what do you think happens to the soul, the life force of people who commit suicide?
Well, you know, it's obviously a time when we think about suicide certainly as involving suffering and pain. And so, you know, that obviously touches all of us, and we feel that. We feel that grief in that person's life experience. I'm one who advocates for people's right to choose. I think there comes a time in a person's life, particularly under, you know, certain kinds of disease states and conditions where, you know, that it becomes the appropriate choice for them to make a transition that would alleviate their suffering. And I think that, again, our huge denial of death as a culture has pathologized that process of dying. And I think to the extent we can reinvigorate our awareness around death, we can help to alleviate additional suffering that happens for people when they're ready to make that transition. In terms of, you know, what I hold from my own spirituality is that the state of mind that we're in at the moment of our transition is going to be very important for what may come next. And so to the extent that, you know, whatever the path is, we can hold clarity and we can hold a sense of peace. You know, I don't know that that's what I'll achieve in the end, but it's certainly what I aspire to. And so, you know, really hoping that people can make their transition with the most clarity, the most sense of calm and purpose. I had a dear friend, Willis Herman, who, you know, was kind of at the end of his life really ready for the next great adventure. You know, to the extent we can hold that as the way, then if death is a change in our frequency, not necessarily, you know, the content, but the frequency of it, then it's important that we be able to make that transition smoothly.
Good. Okay, and of course another question, I'm sure you've heard all these over the years, we've been doing about the same job, is how can I best hear my inner self's voice? How can I know my highest purpose?
have been very active in developing, you know, research and practices around transformations in consciousness. And we published a book called Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday, Everyday Life. And that book helped us to identify a kind of change process. And what we found is that the primary catalyst for these positive life-affirming transformations is some kind of noetic experience. And noetic basically means direct knowing. So it's states of insight that we don't easily put into language. And they can come through self-reflection, meditation, a walk in nature, gardening. Gardening is a great transformative practice. They can really be catalyzed in almost any way, but it involves some ability for us to shut down all the weapons of mass distraction that bombard us all the time and begin to find that place to center and to bring our awareness to our breathing, to the feelings and sensations in our bodies, to the areas that give us inspiration and hope and possibility, and really begin to focus on what gives us joy. Where do we find it easy to move? And, you know, begin to cultivate these qualities. I think that that allows us to create the spaciousness to define what gives us purpose and possibility in our lives. You know, those things are really important. And, you know, right livelihood, finding a job, creating a job, creating a, you know, a means of support for our lives that takes care of the base issues and also provides us with growth opportunities. I think that's a great gift. If we can take joy in our work, that becomes really powerful. Having right community, being in a situation where if things are chaotic all the time, that's really hard on our minds and our bodies. And so finding places of refuge, you know, go to the library, go for a walk in nature, you know, sit quietly someplace where you can center and find the inner resilience that can help to be stronger in the face of the transformations that, you know, come willingly or not in our lives. So, you know, looking at the change model, we have found that this noetic core inner knowing becomes fundamental to making the kinds of positive changes that we want. And then, you know, practice, finding ways to build new habits, setting intention. I intend to have, you know, a cheerier outlook on whatever. I intend to be in greater harmony. I intend to suffer less. I intend to own that the thoughts I'm suffering from are inflicted by myself. How do I change those thoughts? So intention, attention, where are we placing our attention? Is the glass half empty or the glass half full? Paying attention to what we're not paying attention to the extent we can become more and more mindful of all the ways in which culture conditions us. Those are powerful. Repetition, building new habits. Affirmations can be really good for us. We put them around, we remember. You know, we set some goals, little goals, one at a time, and we live into them. We build new habits. That can become extremely good for us. And finding guidance, listening to programs like yours, you know, finding that there are people out there who've been on the path before us, but also finding time to be quiet enough to get the guidance from within us. You know, that becomes really, really powerful. And ultimately, you know, acceptance, acceptance for life as it is, and that we are, you know, part of a process, and that that's a beautiful thing. So these are qualities that I think can help people if they can just slow down and reflect on what gives them purpose and meaning.
Very good. Well, I love how comprehensive your answers are. You draw from so many sources, very eclectic, good stuff. Well, the next question comes from people often from, as you mentioned, more fundamentalist religions who either want to escape the brainwashing, or two, they want to work within. They want to continue attending their church, but they want to try to change it from within. And they ask, how can I evolve beyond my earlier religious teachings that don't make sense to me now, teachings about an eternal fiery hell, one way to God, only one true religion. So many things are being a sin, being gay, we're born in the sin, etc.
What can you share about that, please?
Through the research that I've done on worldview transformation and living deeply, I found that there is a really important kind of literacy, and I call it worldview literacy. And it's the awareness that we all have a worldview, that we can cultivate kinds of practices that will help us to understand better what that worldview is, what informs it, what limits it. You know, these are skill sets that we can learn, and we've actually built a curriculum called Worldview Explorations that can help to facilitate that. And then there's the idea that other people have a worldview that's different from my own, and it may or may not be right, but it's different, and there are ways in which that worldview can cause me to be reactive. And we know that, you know, there's something they call amygdala hijacking, where the old fight or flight part of our brain gets triggered before we're even consciously aware of it. And so to the extent we can become more aware of those little triggers within us, we can then develop our own capacities to be less reactive in the face of difference. So I think, you know, understanding that we each have a worldview, that other people have worldviews that are different from our own, that there are qualities, skills, capacities that we can develop to make us more curious and creative in response to these differences, seeing them as opportunities for a healthy habitat. You know, having a full range of difference can be very, very healthy. And then ultimately, how do those awarenesses about worldview lead to actions in the world? So how do we propel ourselves with meaning and purpose out into lives that are full and rich and juicy? And, you know, so those are the qualities I think that help us to overcome limited thinking. And, again, if people go to my website, marilynschlitz.com, there are sort of gateways into some of these resources that people can at least get next steps from there and, you know, see what comes up for them.
Excellent, excellent. Well, the last two questions we can merge together, and that is, people say, okay, all these understandings, what we've talked about, how can this information help me now to deal with my life's challenges and then also to help me make the world a better place?
Well, I think that this idea of transformation and the various stages of transformation that can invite us to live more deeply, there are, you know, many people for thousands of years who've gone on the path before us, and so we can learn from them. We can also learn by taking time to self-reflect and be mindful about what's true for us. That's important. People just need to give themselves a little more time in the course of a day, in the course of a minute, you know, to just be reflective. And then ultimately, as we begin to transform ourselves, we start to really see the interrelationships between the parts of a whole. And so connecting to our communities, involving ourselves in different kinds of projects that bring us into the world, and we begin to see that life is practice. So practice isn't just something we do on special days at special times, but it's every moment. You know, it's in our carpool, or it's in a difficult situation with a worker in the workplace. You know, those are all opportunities for us. I like to think of road rage as a spiritual practice, because every minute we get the opportunity to check our own reactiveness and, you know, sometimes a little reminder, whether it's the bobble-headed Buddha or the Christ figure or a smiley face or, you know, something funny in our car that reminds us. You know, these little reminders can be very important. So I would say, first of all, we work on ourselves. Secondly, we engage in community in whatever form, whether it, you know, involves listening to a program like yours and really kind of taking it to heart and thinking about some next steps. But reaching out and connecting is really important, and recognizing that life is the practice. So every day, all the time, we have an opportunity to grow. And then ultimately that these systems that we live in, whether it's education, healthcare, business, community, religion, all have the capacity to change and have changed. And the best way to change is from the inside out. So using these same principles of the transformational model to begin to affect whole systems change. One person at a time in a critical mass of people can become a tipping point, and that's where I believe we're at right now. I think with mass communications and a lot of people asking the kinds of questions you're asking, and, you know, us asking them together in ways that can help to create new forms of action, I think it's desperately needed in the world. So I very much celebrate what you're doing.
Excellent. I knew you'd be a great guest, and I wasn't wrong.